now that after I finish speaking, there's going to be a bit of a silence time because this is heavy stuff that we'll be looking at. Jesus in the garden. And so just give you the heads up now that you can, if you don't kind of take everything in at once, or if there's stuff that you kind of go, wow, I want to think about that some more, there's going to be an immediately following a couple minutes silence just to stop and sink it in. As I said, we're heading into the end of Mark's Gospel, but we're not jumping straight into the crucifixion story tonight. We're not even getting into the resurrection tonight. We're actually starting a few hours beforehand in this olive garden with a few guys, and we're listening to this man praying. And it's going to kick off a series of events that changes the course of the world's history. Which sounds grand and grandiose as a vision, but it starts ordinarily. It starts quite pessimistically. You might remember the context from Mark 14. Have a look in your Bibles. It would be great if you kept them open as we read. Jesus has just finished having his last meal with his disciples, and he's broken bread, and he said, you know, you see how this bread is broken? It's going to be like my body given for you. And he's poured out wine for them to drink, and he said, you see how I'm pouring out this wine? It's going to be like my blood shed for your forgiveness. He predicts Judas will betray him. He also predicts all of them will desert him. Even Peter, who says, oh, well, you can't bank on these dudes, but I'm pretty reliable. Even if all fall away, I will not. Jesus says, before the rooster crows three times, you will deny me three times. So what we're seeing here really is Jesus' finish line getting closer and closer and closer. Little else needs to be done. So what does he do but wait and pray? Verse 32, Jesus takes Peter, James and John to Gethsemane. We can understand from history that it was probably part of a bigger estate that was full of olive trees and formed part of an estate near the foot of the Mount of Olives, which was a favourite spot for Jesus and his disciples to go. It's very important that he takes Peter, James and John with him. There's a very specific reason why Jesus takes Peter, James and John with him, and it's this. Each man, in his own way, had misunderstood Jesus' destiny. We think of Peter. I mean, that's an obvious example. During Jesus' life, he pulls Jesus aside and says, no, the Son of Man can't suffer and be handed over to authorities. No, he rebukes him. Jesus gives him the smackdown and says, get behind me, Satan. Peter has just said, oh, well, even if all fall away, I will not. He needs to learn. He needs to be there to learn who really Jesus is and what following him really means. James and John, you might remember if you know Mark, in chapter 10, they said to Jesus, let us sit at your right and left hand in glory. Let us be in glory with you. Come on, small request. Jesus said no, and he said, oh, well, we can drink the cup you're about to drink, and we can be baptized with the baptism you're about to be baptized with. Big claims. James and John need to get their self-confidence checked. Jesus brings them along for that reason. They need to see who Jesus really is, see what following him really means. And as the story goes on, sadly, all three men fail Jesus miserably. They totally miss the point as to what's going on in that crucial hour, and they go asleep. Which proves, very obviously, that Jesus doesn't bring them along as moral support. Please get that idea over your head. If you're wondering if Peter, James and John were kind of like Jesus' groupies, his homies, helping him out at a hard time, trying to be mates, getting together, I'm about to go through a hard day, guys, get around me. It's not like that at all. It's the kind of, in my head, you know, it's the opposite, exact opposite of a prize fighter in the ring kind of doing his bang, 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 and he gets to his corner at the end of the round, and he gets pepped up, a bit of this, you know, a bit of the massage, a bit of the water, a bit of a, you're doing well, son, get back out there. It's not what's going on. When Jesus goes back, checks on his disciples intermittently, he's not the prize fighter going back to his corner. Why does he bring them along then? Why does Peter, James and John belong there? We'll get to that later. Moving on, we see Jesus breaks from the pack. Verse 34. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. Stay here and keep watch. It's fascinating. He doesn't say, stay here and keep watch over me. He doesn't say, stay here and pray for me. He actually says to the disciples, stay here, keep watch. He says later, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. Could it be that the real reason his followers, Peter, James and John, meant to be there was actually for their benefit, not for his? I think so. That he knew what was ahead of them. He knew that as a revolutionary figure he was about to die, and the followers of revolutionary figures, after the leader dies, they don't tend to go that well. Jesus knew this was a crucial hour for his followers, and they failed him. They failed to see this is a crucial hour. So I think they were brought along in the first place. Anyway, Jesus comes back. He says, the Mark tells us he's deeply distressed and troubled. He goes along a little farther. He fell to the ground, prayed that if possible the hour might pass from him. Put all of that together. Here's one really important question to answer. What exactly is troubling Jesus? What exactly is troubling Jesus? I think it's really important to be precise about this because it's possible to get it wrong. It's possible, for example, to simply say Jesus' distress is because he's not looking forward to the pain that's ahead of him. I think that's true, but it's not enough. I think it's true that Jesus did see the cross and he saw what it was going to be like to be crucified, tortured, flogged, what it was going to be like to die, asphyxiate, bleed. I think it's true that the suffering, the physical suffering he's about to endure, troubles Jesus. But there's more. Indeed, Jesus, he knew this was coming. He wasn't ever going to be denied the cross. Peter tried to do that. Jesus called it satanic to deny him the cross. The cross will definitely mean a fatal blow, a physical torture. But Jesus was so unwavering in his commitment to it. That tells us there's something more than imminent pain that is troubling Jesus. So is it a spiritual attack? Is that what's troubling Jesus? Is he coming under satanic pressure? Is that why he's finding it so deeply distressing? Now, this is a good example of when popular movies shape our view of Jesus more than the Bible does. Because if you read this and thought, ah, yes, Jesus was visited by Satan in the garden, odds are you got that idea from watching the Passion of the Christ movie. Is that weird scene where this creature in a black kind of coat and hood comes in, gets to the garden, and there's a snake involved or something. And you see this black hooded creature appear again when Jesus is carrying the cross on the road. It's not in the Bible. It's in Mel Gibson's version of the Passion of the Christ. It's not in the Bible. But that aside, I think it's entirely possible. Indeed, it's likely that Jesus did do battle with Satan in the garden. I mean, it would fit with the rest of his life. Jesus started his life with baptism, sent out to the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, tempted by the devil. It makes sense that Satan might want to bookend Jesus' life at this crucial hour of his mission. Satan would want to distract him, maybe give him some lies to believe, maybe tempt him away from this course of action. Perhaps that is why Jesus was so troubled. Again, though, it doesn't go far enough in explaining Jesus' distress. There's more to it. If there was just spiritual attack going on, we would have heard Jesus refute every attack with God's word like he did in the desert. Jesus doesn't. If it was really just spiritual attack giving Jesus grief, we would hear him pray, ask Peter, James and John to pray for him in his distress. He doesn't. So even though we can say it's likely that Jesus' distress comes from a spiritual attack, we have to say more. And here's the more. Here's the more. We get is what's at the root of Jesus' anguish when we hear his prayer. Verse 36. Abba, Father, he said, everything is possible for you. take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will. What's upsetting Jesus? The thought of taking on himself the sin of the world and being punished like the world deserved to be punished. It all hinges on what the cup means, and it's unmistakable throughout the Old Testament. You can see it in Isaiah, you can see it in Jeremiah, you can see it in the Psalms. The cup is so often followed by a couple of words like the cup of God's wrath or God's anger, the cup of judgment. It was a way of picturing what sinners deserve, what their reward is for being sinners. Drinking from, receiving, experiencing God's judgment, God's punishment. It's, I suppose, another way of explaining what sinners do to God. They reject him, and in the end, he rejects them. So, for Jesus to ask that the cup be spared him, is Jesus contemplating with horror the feeling of being cut off from God? Jesus is going to go to the cross and die for sinners in their place, then he must absorb the anger that God has about sin on his shoulders, the anger that is rightfully yours and mine. Just think for a moment about the cost this is to Jesus. This is a man who has lived his whole life wholly for God. He calls him Abba, Father. This is such an affectionate term. I couldn't call someone else's dad Abba. This is Jesus saying, my Father. This is what little kids shout out to their fathers. If they're still speaking Aramaic in the Middle East, in a village, call out, Abba, Father, I'm running in the street, calling after their papa, their dad. That's what Jesus calls his dad. And now he contemplates bearing the punishment for sin on his shoulders, and he knows that means that there's going to be a whole gulf open up. It's going to separate him, albeit temporarily, but awfully separate him from his dad. That is what he's so upset about. The son about to be cut off from his father. For the sake of love, for the sinners who put him in that place. That's what he is so upset about. So Jesus prays, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. In other words, can there be another way? Yet not what I will, but what you will. Now we can't know how long a pause exists in Jesus when he said it, how long a pause existed between take this cup from me and yet not what I will but what you will. I'm guessing it wasn't as quick as I just said it then, 3 seconds. I'm guessing it wasn't as quick in reality as Abel read it, a couple of seconds. I'm guessing that there was a pause. We don't know for sure. What we do know is Jesus goes and prays the same thing 3 times, verse 39 tells us. So, it was a struggle, a tussle, an agonizing blood, sweat, and tears moment. But, and this is so important, Jesus keeps 2 truths together. He says both, not one or the other, both. This is painful and this is God's will. Not one, not the other, but both. This is painful. And this is God's will. We're going to unpack that a bit more later for us. Things in the garden are getting wound up. Verse 41. He returns the 3rd time, says to his disciples, are you sleeping still and resting? Enough, the hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer. I mean, that's, to me, amazing. This is a readiness that I can't comprehend. A boldness that Jesus displays to just say, hey, I'm embracing the cross here. Where does he get that confidence from? Can't be from anywhere else but a solid commitment to the will of God. A complete agreement and willing choice to go to the cross. It's the only way it can be explained. You might be thinking, so what do a few hours in Middle Eastern Garden lots of years ago matter to me now? Let me tell you a couple of things why it matters. Firstly, when it comes to us and Jesus, us in our struggle, him in the garden, we're going through the same thing. We're the same. But equally, when it comes to us and Jesus, we're not the same. Us in our struggles, him in the garden, he went through a whole lot more than you or I ever go through. Let me go through them each point. Firstly, there is so much comfort to be taken for your distress, for my despair, when you look at Jesus in the garden. Like I said earlier, Jesus, at least to some extent, was distressed about the pain he was about to suffer. Jesus was at least to some extent distressed over the satanic oppression he was feeling. We know what that's like, don't we? You just ask any Christian who's had an addiction to pornography, when he's sitting at his computer and he's home alone, you ask him how hard the battle is, and you ask him how hard it is to choose God's will at that moment. You can almost hear him praying equivalents to Jesus' prayer, yet not what I will, but what you will. Help me choose what is best. I know your way is best. Help me choose what you want, not what I want. Here's another way. Jesus and us are the same. Like we said earlier, he had to be at least in some way distressed over the physical pain ahead of him, even though he knew it was God's plan. We can relate to that, can't we? We know God allows sicknesses in our life. We know that he allows tragedies in our life. We know that he allows various loved ones to die. We sometimes call it like the worst thing that's ever happened. But God, he knows it's a means to an end. He knows it's going to result in more prayer, more passion, more love, more heaven focus. And that's the message of the Joseph story. You heard it, Pilate read, just the end of it. Joseph, take this guy, he's got some pretty mean brothers who sell him to Egypt in a pot. In the end, he becomes the main food distributor for the famine. His brothers come back to that land because they're hungry. And he experienced that this is painful. He didn't enjoy being locked up in a pot and sold off by his own family. He didn't enjoy the envy that they had of him for his technicolor dream coat. But he also said, did you hear him? This is God's will. Let me just read that combination. Verse 20. You intended to harm me, he said to his brothers, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So that's a combination of this is painful and not either or, and this is God's will. Jesus did that too. You know, he saw the angry mob with pitchforks and with clubs. He knew that trumped up charges were coming his way. He knew that a mockery of a trial was about to be undertaken, that he would eventually be flogged, crucified. Awful means to a glorious end. The saving of many lives. We can do the same. We have to say both. This is painful and this is God's will. Let me tell you, this is so recent. This is so current. This is so real right here, right now. Some of you may know we support a missionary called Naomi. She's over in Durban, South Africa. Let me tell you about her last couple of days. She was caring for a girl who had tuberculosis and a collapsed lung. She took her to the hospital, and this girl wasn't getting seen. There was no attention being given. Eventually, she got seen, and she was able to go home, but Naomi, in the process, she thinks she's caught TB. She was in the hospital. She's still in the hospital. And she got word. I'll read out what her prayer letter said. While physically at my weakest, my flat had been broken into, robbed and trashed the night before. She then goes on to say that she thought in her head, oh my gosh, my ring. It was a ring that her friends from her old church had given her, engraved with the words, to live is Christ, to die is gain. And she says, this is what she says. Just keep in mind, she's potentially got a disease that she got from caring for someone. Her house has just been trashed. This is what she says. In a strange way, I am thankful for this severe mercy of God that reminds me, warns me, not to place my value, my sense of myself or worth in anything apart from Him. She went home and she found the ring. They didn't take it. This is painful, and this is God's will. There are some similarities. You can look at the garden and you can see in your own life and Jesus, hey, we're the same. And yet, we're not the same. Us in our struggles, Him in the garden, He just went through so much more. I mean, He perfectly obeyed. Not like the addicts at their computer or at their shopping centers or at their alcohol bottles and in their mirrors who kind of come through for God 5 times out of 10. Jesus never caves. And then the differences between us and Him, they're deeper than just Him being the best version of us. Just call to mind what we heard about the cup. The cup that Jesus asked would pass, but that He chose to drink, the penalty for sin, about to be born on His shoulders, separation, a son from a father. If you understand what it means for Jesus to drink the cup, and the enormous gulf that was about to open up between Him and God, then you understand it's impossible. It's impossible for you to say, now I know exactly what Jesus was going through. You don't. I don't. And actually, you know what? Because He went through what He went through, you don't have to. That's the gospel message. If you never heard anything about Christianity, or if you even heard about it 50 times, this is the heart of it. All have sinned and have punishment coming. And if Jesus doesn't deal with it, you do. A Christian is just someone who's banking on Jesus bearing God's anger at their sin. And then they live freely. Not because they deserve it, not because they've earned it, but they live with joy and forgiveness and life. That's what a Christian is. I had a fight with my wife this morning before I got up to preach. I'm a Christian. I'm not banking on my own goodness to be good enough for God. I deserve the punishment of God for the way I spoke to her and millions of other sins I've committed. Out of love, Jesus takes that punishment for me. So I bank on that. If you're not banking on that, if you're not banking on Jesus to experience the horror of hell on your behalf, get ready to experience it for yourself. Put that bluntly, I know that's blunt, put that bluntly, I hope you can see the tragedy of refusing a free gift, that you get what you don't deserve. Jesus gets what He doesn't deserve. You get life, He gets death. This is why the Garden of Gethsemane matters, people. These few hours in the garden, this is not just about a really good moral example of being humble and submissive to the will of God. Please don't come away with that message tonight. This is not just about Jesus who's perfectly done a moral thing and being self-sacrificial. That stops way too short. The meaning of this story is that the Son of God proves His love for you, He proves His love for me, and He willingly chooses the cross, knowing what it would entail, to bring me and God together, to bring you and God together. This is no ordinary night. I hope that's obvious. And it would set in train an extraordinary series of events. I certainly pray that over the coming weeks, as we look to the end of Jesus' life, and then we get to the start of His life at Christmas, that we have this in mind. This free gift is on offer. It's going to be some silence now. Then the band will come up.